versus Simon Property Group, which is the type of.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Beth Typhus. I am counsel for appellant Simon Property Group. There are three significant points I'd like to go over today. First, the phrase 1% equity in clicks and mortar, structure to be determined, is so vague and indefinite that it cannot be enforced.
Would you make the same argument if it just said 1% equity and didn't have the structure thing in it?
I think that that would be vague and indefinite as well, but when you add the structure to it, because there are so many questions about what structure could possibly mean or possibly relate to.
Well, Ash Lab gave testimony on that. She was your president, so she ought to know.
She gave testimony about that, as did
and the judge believed her, so why isn't that the end of the story?
This isn't a question of credibility, Your Honor. It's not a question of what testimony.
No, Ashlab explains what the thing means and clarifies it, and she's the president of the company, and your fellow Simon doesn't testify. I don't know what is left to argue about,
well,
except the damages.
Well, the contract was made with Ms. Haslund, and Ms. Haslund's understanding of what
structure
meant.
But Ashlab testifies, and she knows she's the president. I don't know what.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, we have a contract that is ambiguous on its face. If we are to go to parole evidence, if we are to go to...
It's ambiguous. I mean, if you look at the contract on A21, A22, it looks like a perfectly standard contract. I don't know what the... nothing funny about it. I mean, it says annual salary $175,000. Now, would you argue that was vague because it doesn't say whether it's to be paid monthly or weekly or at the end of the year or...
No, we would not argue that.
Okay, so if structure just means, you know, how many shares, whether they're Class B, whether they have voting rights and so on, why is that any more of a important detail?
Well, if the parties had agreed and both had all had an understanding that that, in fact, was what structure meant, then perhaps
well, that's
would be a
Ashlab
different
testifies.
Case.
Well, that's what testifies.
The question here, though, is structure of what?
Yeah, but Ashlab testified as to what it meant. It just meant, you know, class, voting rights, that's number of shares. He believed her, Judge Shader. I don't know why you need anything more.
What we have, Your Honor, is Alshab saying at one point, I put structure to be determined in there because we did not have the equity structure determined for clicks. Ms. Haslund, however, disagrees with that. She
yes, I know, but if you have disagreement, it's for the trier of fact to sort it out.
It is for the trier of fact, but if there is a question not as to credibility, but as to whether there was an agreement, then it is important to look at that testimony.
You say there are two inconsistent witnesses. The judge has to choose between them. I don't understand you. That's what credibility is about, not whether they're lying, but who does the judge think has the better fix on what the parties were, what the meaning of the contract was.
It seems to me, Your Honor, that what we need in a contract is an agreement. We need a common understanding of the terms. And so it is not a question of did the judge below believe this witness or that witness. It is when these witnesses entered into the agreement, did they understand what they were saying? Did they have a common understanding?
Right, and that's what they testified to. It's an extrinsic evidence case. The witnesses give testimony to try to explain what the contract means because it's a short contract and it's in its particular application here, and the judge believes one of them, and your guy Simon apparently knows absolutely nothing about the transaction, so naturally the judge gives weight to what Ashlab testified to, and he had to put that together with what the other witnesses testified to, so I don't know what you're arguing about.
One of the important aspects of indefiniteness in this contract is even if we can accept that there was a common understanding of structure, is by when was this structure to be determined? And this is a very important consideration, a significant matter here, given the brevity of Ms. Haslam's length of employment. Her tenure at Clicks and Mortar, which itself was quite short-lived, her tenure was just 10 months. And the question is, by when was this structure to be put in place? Did it need to be put in place by the time that Clicks and Mortar rolled a product out for market? Did it need to be put into place by the time?
Why does that matter?
Well, both under
whenever it's put in place, she's entitled to her 1% according to the contract.
Well, both this court.
She left her job. She had a good job, apparently. She left to take a risk on this startup, and she wanted equity, and that's what she was promised. And then you don't give her anything.
She took a risk on a startup.
I mean, she said that the equity was a deal breaker. Now you're saying it was completely empty. She got nothing.
Even if the parties intended to contract, Your Honor, it may be that what they put together as an agreement is so vague and indefinite it simply can't be enforced.
Do you have any other case in which a promise of equity was not enforced on that ground?
There is a case in the Second Circuit that I can bring to your attention shortly in which an options promise was made. There was no, it was a promise made orally. There was not a writing. But what was significant to the court was that there was a certain amount of indefiniteness, although it did not mirror the indefiniteness here. And that also the realization that when a company is promising a grant of options in that case or a grant of equity in this case, one would expect a much lengthier and more detailed document that would speak to the kinds of issues that are generally spoken to when a company is granting a stake. So it would speak to the restrictions.
So why didn't your company write a longer contract?
Sorry?
Why didn't your company write a longer contract?
I think that the fact that there is not information provided in this meant that all of that was still to be determined, as the writing itself says, the offer letter itself says, to be determined. And all that that meant was that had not been established, that had not been agreed to, and that in itself goes to the fact that this was not sufficiently definite to be enforced. One would have expected to see information about vesting and about restrictions.
ASVAB said there were no restrictions.
And if that is the case, one would have expected.
And the judge believed him.
There are, of course, restrictions that operate by law. There are Securities and Exchange restrictions that she would have been subject to. There's no question about that. Ms. Alshab herself.
And you don't have to put it in the contract.
Typically, those do not have to, but the restrictions, other restrictions,
but
if any.
But she said there were no other restrictions.
And you, one would expect.
And the judge believed her.
Yes, she did. And but
so
one.
So what left? What's left for us?
I think what's left is the realization that when you look at this contract and then you look at how things operate in the real world, as this court has done before, you realize that a contract of this sort ordinarily.
Did you put in evidence about the real world?
No, we didn't, but it was Ms. Haslam's burden to demonstrate.
You recognize, of course, that up here we don't even recognize this world, let alone the real world.
Right.
We live in an ethereal sort of thing.
You live in a dream world.
Without getting into the ethereal world, the point is that in
you
a...
You arrived here.
Yes, I did. In a contract to convey equity, restrictions, whether or not there are any, ordinarily are addressed. Vesting, whether or not there is a vesting period, ordinarily is addressed. And Ms. Alshab testified that her own...
You say ordinarily, what's the evidence for that?
Ms. Alshab, the evidence in this record, Ms. Alshab testified herself that equity that she was granted previously in a Simon entity through her prior employment with Simon Property.
Yeah, that's one incident. Is there testimony about what's ordinary?
There is not testimony beyond that, Your Honor.
Is this sort of contract, in your opinion, a usual contract that is offered to prospective employees that's at her level?
Employees at her level sometimes are entitled or able to take advantage of equity grants, sometimes not.
Is it a normal process is what I'm asking. Is it a usual business in the business that you're talking about? Is this usually the way it's done?
To my understanding, Your Honor, and because there's nothing in the record that Ms. Haslund put in about this, but often there's...
See, I was being flippant about the real world, but the world of this type, I'm totally unfamiliar with, and
Ordinarily, an offer letter is followed by an employment agreement which can hammer out details, and...
there was no such agreement.
It was stipulated by Ms. Haslund that she was negotiating her employment agreement nearly up until the day that she left.
If you want to save some time for rebuttal, you're into rebuttal time now.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your pointing that out, and I would like to save some time for rebuttal. I would, though, like to get to the question of damages, since we have not had an opportunity to talk about that. Ms. Haslund failed to provide any reasonable basis for assessing damages here.
Did you provide any evidence on damages?
We did not provide any evidence.
We've seen this in other cases before, where you have plaintiff puts in evidence, maybe highly imperfect on damages, and has a number, the $500,000, and then the defendant just denies that there are any damages. So it's like final order arbitration. The judge awards either zero or awards the $500,000. You didn't put in any evidence which might suggest, you know, that $50,000 was a reasonable amount. It seems odd that it would be zero if this equity was totally worthless.
Well, given that it was a startup
company. What about an intermediate number?
If we were going back today, it might have, you know, looking back, we might have done it differently. But what we can say about the numbers that are in the record, Your Honor, is that these are not market value numbers. The judge below looked at transactions that were primary market transactions. These were not transactions that established fair market value in any sense of the word. And therefore, there's no basis for relying on them to establish a value. And of course, this was a startup company with no assets, no revenue.
Why didn't you offer any evidence on it? What did you want the judge to guess, or what?
We believed that the evidence.
No, he had a guess on the record here, didn't he?
We believed that the judge had enough before him to understand that the transactions that were presented to him were not transactions of secondary market transactions, that in a company that had no assets, no product...
If I take your argument correctly, no matter what figure he arrived at based on the record, in this case it had to be a guess or a speculation. It had no firm root in what was true.
I believe that is correct. Perhaps nominal damage.
Well, there is material. Of course, there is stuff in the record suggesting that your people, Simon, valued it at $52 million. So 1% of that is $500,000.
Well, I don't quibble with the math, Your Honor, at all.
There is that $52 million staring at us.
Right.
Your estimate of the value of the company. So why wouldn't a 1% equity interest have some value? Might not be $500,000, but wouldn't be zero. I'd like to have 1% of a $50 million company.
As obviously would many people, but what we have here is not a company with $53 million in equity. We have a company where entities have contributed either in-kind or dollar startup
right. And of course
money.
They do that because they think there's value there.
Well, they do
right?
that in this
they
case.
They were wrong because, you know, the bubble burst and so on, but her argument is that there was a period in which the market thought this company did have a positive value, and she had a piece of it, and she would have sold it. Now, you know, I think that the business, whether she could have found anyone to buy it, I think that is highly speculative, but I don't think it's a matter of zero evidence.
But the market didn't place any value because there was no market value to this stock. There was no market for this stock. If I may reserve the rest.
Yes, sure. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Nolan?
May it please the court, Timothy Nolan for the plaintiff, Appellee Shannon Haslund. This court should affirm the district court's judgment order in its entirety. First, the court concluded correctly that the two people who negotiated and entered this agreement shared a mutual understanding and intent as to all terms of the employment agreement. Second, in assessing damages arising out of Simon's breach and its failure to provide Haslin her promised 1% equity interest, the court relied on relevant, ascertainable evidence in determining a market value of Clicks and Mortar and Haslin's 1%.
Okay, pause there and tell me how. How he arrived at that figure.
He arrived at that figure by looking at a number of factors pointing to market value. First, the court recognized that the defendant itself articulated in 2001 and 2000 that Clicks and Mortar had significant ongoing value.
Well, that's a nice vague number.
I'm sorry, Judge.
I said that's a nice vague number, right?
Well,
whack at it again, see.
It doesn't give me the number, but I'll put these items in a row because taken individually, I think they had impact, but taken collectively, I think they were compelling. The document that I had in mind was the May 9 earnings report, May 9, 2001 earnings report, where David Simon, speaking to investors, speaking to the public, speaking to stockbrokers, informs them that Clicks is developing a second-generation product. Mm-hmm. He also reports that retailers, the market, mm-hmm. has received it enthusiastically. He then goes on to state that there's significant, he believes, there's significant ongoing value in this technology. This isn't a corner drugstore. This is a Simon property.
I heard what he said. I know what he said. We still haven't arrived at a number.
3 weeks later, CPG purchases a 9.3% minority stake in Clicks and Mortar for $5 million cash. And I believe that is an arm's length transaction that evidences market value.
That pegs it for you. That pegs it for the court so we can now compute the value of the lady's 1%.
That's in part, yes. And then there's more. There, of course, is the earlier transaction with Found.com, which takes place right on the heels of Haslin's termination. In that case, I know there was no cash exchange for that equity interest, but there was value. And the critical thing there is that in the meeting that occurs a couple months after this transaction, a meeting attended by Simon Property Group and Clicks and Mortars, senior officers, they're discussing the impact of this transaction, and one, David Simon admitted that he dictated those terms.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have to be 6.9%. Could have been zero, could have been something more if the company didn't relate to $3.7 million in relation to 6.9%. It's also clear in the Plaintiff's Exhibit 42 that these are terms that they agreed to, and then, as a result of that transaction, there's an implied value of $52 or $50 million, depending on the scrivener's notations there. Frankly, I think that document alone, written by Simon's people, contemporaneous right to the date of Haslin's termination, is the type of ascertainable, relevant evidence of market value. But we don't take it alone. We take it in conjunction with Simon's admission several months later that Clicks and Mortar has significant ongoing value. And then, 3 weeks after that, we have this outside party paying not work, paying not reduction in fees, but paying cold, hard cash to Simon in the form of $5 million.
Who is that?
That's CPG.
But didn't Simon make investment in CPG at the same time?
Yes.
So there's no net transfer of funds?
There is not. I look at it this way, Judge Posner. If you sell me your house and I sell you my house, they're worthless, we'll probably just exchange them or perhaps reference nominal consideration. But I submit, if you sell me your house for $500,000 and I sell you my house for $500,000, we have not nullified market value because the cash is awash at the end of the day. In fact, we have proven that both homes have a market value of $5 million, and that is the CPG transaction. CPG.
So you can establish the market value of a home by two homeowners can do a swap on And the same thing, that establishes market value for purposes of evaluating other homes in an area?
Yes, I think you could if they're comparable. Sure.
Really?
Sure. And
but
if the
problem is, of course,
you
they
can work that out yourself and establish it for the whole community.
Right. They could swap it at $1, at $1 million, at any, it would be all
right. There's a condemnation proceeding coming forward down the line, so we said we want to swap these things, and we now establish fair market value for the condemnation for the neighborhood?
No, we haven't.
Why not?
Because there's no indication as to what the value is or what the market might have
well,
been.
Well, you just said it was the market value. Five. You swap five, I swap five, that makes it 5,000.
But it wasn't a swap. It wasn't one company for another. It was
what would have prevented the two companies from saying, I'll give you $10 million and you give me $10 million rather than $5 million and $5 million?
That's what I'm talking about.
It wouldn't cost them anything.
No, it wouldn't have.
All they would do would create an inflated impression of the value of the two companies.
They could have done that. There was no evidence that was done.
Don't you
here,
need
though.
Independent evidence that $5 million does represent, 10% of the value of each of the companies?
I think when you corroborate it, it makes it very compelling, and I think that's what the found transaction did. I think
the other problem I have with your damages evidence is, how likely is it that she could have actually found a buyer? Suppose she had 1% of the equity pursuant to the contract. How likely is it that she could actually have found a buyer for that in the interval before the bubble burst?
I believe it was likely because of the evidence that was presented. First of all, there was a demand for direct investment in Clicks and Mortar going back to 2000. The testimony from both
elements. But it's one thing to go into the company, get stock issued by the company, become an insider, and so on. Another thing to buy from a former employee, and then you're just an outsider, and you haven't put any money into the company. You're just a 1% fly on the window. So that's not a very attractive position to be in. An investor.
It may not be attractive, but that does not mean it would not have been in demand. CPG was content to take a 9.3%. I don't think it's at all unreasonable to infer that they may very well have wished to take more. And also, Haslin's stock...
They hadn't put any cash in for that 9%, whereas your theory is they would have laid out $500,000 cash to her. There isn't any indication anyone wanted actually to provide cash, not to the company, but just to become an investor, right? If you provide cash to the company, you strengthen the company, that improves its prospects. But if you just buy from another shareholder, the company doesn't get anything.
That's true, but I still refer you to as Al Shab's testimony, where she said, specifically as to Chelsea and CPG, that they wanted direct investment in Clicks and Mortar. They weren't looking, as I recall her testimony, to venturing or partnering. They wanted a direct investment in Clicks and Mortar, and they eventually got it.
Is it your theory that this money that's pumped into the company creates an equity value equal to those investments?
The CPG money, Your
yeah.
Honor? Yes, I believe it does, yes. I think it reflects...
Is that based on general accounting procedures?
No, it is not.
And accounting principles?
Or
is that something that you fellas just worked out among yourselves?
Oh, I think it works out based on the way Simon handled the figures. I think Simon Property Group reflected that $5 million wire transfer to his company.
But you say that is not accepted in the general accounting procedures.
I don't think the general accounting procedures were at issue, but here I don't think they played
they were,
a part.
Is that an accepted procedure?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know here, for purposes of valuing Clicks and Mortar, Simon Property Group recognized that the $5 million paid by CPG reflected a 9.3% value of the whole company. Now, whether or not he was adhering to general accounting principles in doing so, I don't know. But I do know that CPG and Simon recognized that that was the market value at that time. The $5 million divided by the 53 total that Simon saw in his company represents precisely the 9.3%. I would also add this, that whether or not we can say with certitude that Ms. Haslin would have sold her 1% is something that we're not privy to because of the fact that Simon withheld her stock. It never issued her shares, even though she demanded it repeatedly, and even though Mr. Simon personally on two occasions promised that it would be there. So I think we have the equitable principles that arise out of Bigelow and RKO that say if we have any uncertainty as to whether or not Haslin could truly have sold her interest, that inference should be drawn in her favor. She did nothing, nothing whatsoever, to develop that uncertainty. That uncertainty arose solely because of Simon's conduct in not providing that stock. So if there's any question as to the validity of her ability to sell, or whether or not she could have enjoyed the same percentage based on a CPG purchase, I think that uncertainty must fall on the shoulders of Simon. I would also add this. There's a line of cases I cited in my brief where when we're dealing with a closely held company, sometimes there never is a market, and that's not even in dispute. Nonetheless, Illinois law is quite clear on this. Where there is no market, and you have stocks and shares in a closely held corporation, the trial court is nonetheless obligated.
But did you present expert evidence that would have explained what kind of marketability or value this stock would have? Because maybe realistically, you know, the market would demand a huge discount. So, you know, maybe she could have sold it for $50,000 rather than $500,000.
The answer to your question.
Neither side apparently put in expert evidence.
Correct. We did not. I believe there are a couple of cases I said in my brief where that valuation analysis of the trial court is to conduct, even in situations where there is no market, does not require expert testimony. The court needs to be presented and needs to make some rational basis based on the evidence that is ascertainable. And I submit that this was evidence of market value. But even should you decide that it wasn't and that the district court erred in making that conclusion, it is still the best evidence that was available. In the Ash versus Sunshine case and the other state cases I cited at the end of my brief make this clear that the court, even in a situation where there isn't a market, and we know that there isn't a market perhaps, then the court must look at that best available evidence and in a rational method attempt to determine damages. Just because there is no market does not mean Ms. Haslin is entitled only to nominal damages, and Ash versus Sunshine makes that very clear. She is entitled to something more than nominal damages, and the court did its work and found a rational basis for calculating those.
How could she have sold her equity interest to a third party around the time that she was terminated?
There was nothing that came into evidence that I'm aware of that would precluded her from doing
it. How could she have done it? How would they have set the value?
Haslin would have walked in and said, here's what I think the company is worth. Here's the found transaction, 6.9% in exchange for $3.7 million. Here's Plaintiff's Exhibit 42, where David Simon's saying, here's an implied value of $50 million. Here's the earnings reports. Many of them, not just the May 9, 2001 earnings report, but the May 9 one in particular, says significant ongoing value. What do you think about this? And then there's CPG, a real estate company, a competent investor in this particular field, prepared to pay $5 million in a subscription agreement for a 9.3% interest. Here's my 1%. And my 1% isn't laden with any restrictions. It's unconditional. It's all yours to do with whatever you want. That
Could
is
really
worth something.
I mean, would it really have been completely unconditional? Because what if she shows up for work and the next day she quits and she says, well, thank you very much. You know, I'm going to go back to Ernst & Ernst, wherever she was. And by the way, thank you for, you know, having given me this $500,000 chunk of stock. I mean, wouldn't that be odd?
It would have been very odd, and I assume there would have been a counterclaim for fraud or something
else. No, not fraud. She had no preconceived plan. She shows up. She doesn't like the office. She has this, you know, 1% interest, so she leaves. I mean, when stock is issued to employees as an inducement for them to come to work, Isn't there usually some, you know, vesting requirement to have to wait 2 years or something like that? Isn't that common?
I think it's common.
It's this real world context that we haven't been given
this is
evidence about.
This is specific equity. This was founder's equity, and both Al Shab and Haslin testify that this is a particular type of equity that is reserved for key people, people who are necessary.
That's right, but the key people are hired on the expectation that they're going to do something.
Yes, and Haslin
did.
And
if the person leaves after 1 day, so you think there would be, that when they got around to fixing this structure, the structure would include some kind of vesting requirement.
All I can say, Judge, is they could have included those terms, and they did not.
Well, no, but remember, the contract may well be complete enough to be an enforceable contract, but the details that were left for later, like the structure, might be highly germane to damages, right? So suppose we thought that, realistically, she would not have been able, permitted to sell her stock for a year. Well, in that event, you know, she wouldn't have any damages because the bubble would have burst by then.
There were no such restrictions, and Al Shab and Haslin made it very clear that she was entitled to this from day one, that there was no vesting requirement other than her showing up for work on day one, which she did, and therefore it vested immediately. And frankly, I guess if she left the next day under this contract, she was entitled to it.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Nolan.
Thank you.
Ms. Heifetz, how much time does she have? 1 minute?
Thank you. There really are two questions that are raised. One is, was there value, and could she have realized on the value? The fact that courts can establish a value where there is no market doesn't really help us here, because for example, in the case of a closely held corporation, the court may not have an actively traded stock, but they look to all the circumstances of that business. Here, if you look to all the circumstances, you can see that there is no value. The circumstances are a product that doesn't ever materialize, no assets, no revenue stream. Secondly, the transactions that the judge looked to simply aren't comparable. The judge didn't look at all the circumstances. The judge below based his determination on isolated sales, and he based it on a price that isn't consistent with market price. A stock that's not traded in an efficient market can't be relied upon as establishing the market price.
Okay, thank you
very
much. Heifetz, thank you to both counsel. Next case for